Political Philosophy is a Moran Academy podcast. And today, I am returning to Science, Politics, and Gnosticism by Eric Voegelin. And this is part of the larger series on this book. So if you like this, you should go back and watch the first one, find the playlist. I do a lot of playlists, so look for those on my channel. At any rate, I'm in the chapter called Science, Politics, and Gnosticism. And as I indicated last time, Eric Voegelin seemed to have a particular problem with Marxism. And so I want to explore today why Voegelin thought that Marx was a Gnostic thinker and why he thought that that was a, quote, intellectual swindle and that Marx was an intellectual swindler. Now, I do think, you know, that part of what's going on here is the times in which Voegelin is living, the times that he's reacting to. And so for him, Marxism looms large, and perhaps he a little bit unfairly focuses in on it. But even in this piece, he does admit that to a certain extent, other modern isms, modern movements, basically commit the same error, including the large category of just positivism, modern positivism. So he uses Marx as kind of like a focused example. And it seems sometimes like an attack, but I don't know if we need to take it that way. Now, he says flat out, Marx is a speculative Gnostic. And remember that a Gnostic, as far as how he's using the term, is somebody who looks for that hidden meaning and that key that allows one to kind of understand reality and not only understand it, but to manipulate it. And he focuses in on Marx's early economic and philosophical manuscripts to try to show that Marx is a speculative Gnostic. And he says that these early writings contain the, quote, prohibition of questions that Voegelin has been pointing out previously. He very much disagrees with what he sees as the modern tendency to prohibit questions about existence, the metaphysical questions. And I guess the way I see it is that another line of attack here that I've seen other thinkers use is, like Strauss, for instance, is to just go to modern positivism, to go to that moment in time when political science separated off from political philosophy, you might say, the Machiavellian moment, the point where political thought attempts to abandon questions about what is ultimately true and, you know, what is good. Okay. So he doesn't use the same method, but he's trying to get at the same problem that Strauss did. And he just flat out says, Marx does not have an adequate answer to the question about origins. He doesn't have an answer to the argument of infinite regress, which just means, you know, think about this. Even when you were a kid, you probably thought, well, what comes before this and what came before that? And, you know, you think your way back to at least a sort of imaginative origin. You realize that everything had to, you know, I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around the idea that there was no origin of things. So our minds tend to go to an origin. And he's saying that, you know, I mean, really what he's saying is for most people that ends up speculations about God. It ends up with speculations about a first mover at the very least. And Marx, he says, does not want to ask those questions, kind of prohibits the question about our origins. And, you know, he does this, by the way, for the same reason, I think, that modern thinkers generally tend in that direction, which is they don't think it's a question that can be answered. And therefore, to the extent that we speculate on it, we are deviating our attention from more fruitful pursuits that we can actually achieve. That's sort of like the go-to modern defense of that move. So Vogelin writes, to such questions prompted by the tangible experience that man does not exist of himself, Marx chooses to reply that they are a product of abstraction, meaning the questions are a product of abstraction. And then Vogelin quotes Marx, when you inquire about the creation of nature and man, you abstract from nature and man, end quote. And then Vogelin continues, nature and man are real only as Marx construes them in his speculation. Should his questioner pose the possibility of their non-existence, then Marx could not prove that they exist. So, in other words, Marx just refuses to engage on a question like, you know, why do we need to exist to begin with? And this is a necessary move for at least the theory part of modern science, really. And a lot of scientific work has been built upon abstracting, you might say, and only focusing in on that which you can see and measure and count. Okay, so that's he's pointing at something that's just ubiquitous move that has helped to build up science. But I don't think Vogelin would disagree with that statement that I just made. But he disagrees with the tendency of the scientific mind to say, and those questions of existence are not valid, or that, you know, they're not important and they have no bearing upon what we do. Vogelin argues that Marx breaks off debate by arguing that for socialist man, such a question becomes a practical impossibility. And this is where he calls Marx an intellectual swindler, which is it's a remarkable thing for a scholar to say. I found the language to be really interesting here. An intellectual swindler is like fighting words or something, and it's not what you expect in a scholarly manuscript. I think that it for me, it kind of speaks to the level of feeling that Vogelin had, or his, you know, antipathy for communism in particular, that he would use that type of language. But he does point out, to be fair, that Marx is not alone in this maneuver, and he points to National Socialists basically as doing the same thing. And this is also where he identifies positivism as a main culprit. And positivism is, to maybe back up and explain further, is the modern move in which you say, for instance, in law, justice is only what human beings legislate. There can be no natural justice or natural law or anything like that, because that's just theoretical speculation. But we know when laws are made. The classic positivist problem is, well, when dictators make laws, then those are valid laws, even if they end up being grossly abusive or discriminatory and so on. Positivism has the problem of validating whatever is. And this is particularly problematic in the human range, right? What human beings do. Because we don't want to validate just anything that people do. But the positivist has perhaps no way of doing otherwise. They refuse to ask the question about ultimate ends, greatest good, you know, justice, and certainly the origins of existence. All right. So then he brings in Nietzsche as a thinker that can help him to think further about Marx. Because for him, Nietzsche is a thinker who is very self-conscious about this prohibition of questioning. Nietzsche, perhaps he would say much more than Marx, was keenly aware of the problem of letting go of these metaphysical questions, of letting go of the hope of asking and getting an answer to God questions. And this is what tormented Nietzsche and led to him trying to find some way beyond this modern tragedy. And this was, you know, Nietzsche's building up of the of various aspects of his theory, including eternal return, but certainly of this will to power, this idea that within the human being is the will to power, the will to dominion, the libido dominandi, which is, again, the will to power, the desire to dominate. And Vogland says, the spirit's will to mastery is served in the first place by a suddenly erupting resolve for ignorance, for arbitrary occlusion, a kind of defensive stand against much that is knowable. Moreover, the spirit will to let itself be deceived on occasion. The spirit wills to let itself be deceived on occasion. So I think he captures Nietzsche's mood, for instance, in The Birth of Tragedy, On the Advantage and Disadvantage for Life, The Genealogy of Morals, Thus Spake Zarathustra. So many of Nietzsche's writings involve this really tortured grappling with the problem of truth, the problem of ultimate origins, and what are we going to do now that we cannot believe in these ultimate origins? Because Nietzsche grasped how problematic the not just modern science, but the modern social science, modern thought generally, historicism. He recognized the huge challenge to our set beliefs. Everything was disrupted. And so, you know, he was grappling with, can we replace it? Can we exercise our own will to power and in effect become like gods unto ourselves, defining right and wrong according to our arbitrary desires. So he is saying here that Nietzsche very consciously turned away from the question of truth, knowing what he was doing, and very consciously began to urge the construction of horizons, or, you know, basically created truths of the moment for the individual, but also maybe for the society. So this is why Vogland next says about Nietzsche, the remoter depths of the will to power are revealed through the following aphorism by Nietzsche. So then he quotes Nietzsche, to rule and to no longer be the servant of a god, this means was left behind to a noble man, end quote. Left behind after the death of God, so to speak, to rule and to know no longer and to no longer be the servant of a god, this means was left behind to a noble man. And then Vogland says, to rule means to be God. In order to be God, Gnostic man takes upon himself the torments of deception and self-laceration. So here Vogland is saying that Nietzsche also is maybe the quintessential modern Gnostic man. And he takes upon himself consciously, in a way that many he thought did not, and I think he would be right about that, consciously takes upon himself not only self-deception, but self-laceration. And the reason why he says that is because from Vogland's point of view, in order to continue in conscious sort of like masking self-deception, you have to do continual harm to your true self, that part of yourself that knows that you're deceiving, that part of yourself that wants something higher and better, and that has to constantly say, no, you are enough, you are enough, you are enough, when you're not enough. According to Vogland's perspective, you're not enough and that this move turns people into these self-deceiving, limited beings. So it is this consciousness of self-deception that is particularly troubling to Voegelin. He says the Gnostic movement does not lead to the erotic opening of the soul, but rather to the deepest reach of persistence in the deception, where revolt against God is revealed to be its motive and purpose. And it's interesting that he's not only examining Nietzsche here, but of course, remember, he's reflecting back onto Marx. And he's actually seeing in Marx's earlier manuscripts, which, you know, like, this may not be the case, right? But I'm saying he sees in Marx's early manuscripts this same level of sort of conscious self-deception. So it cannot lead to this erotic opening of the soul, which he has previously identified with true philosophy. You know, that is the source of true philosophy, is the love of the deepest truths and the opening of the soul in order to seek those truths. Instead, it has to sort of close that off, and its revolt against God becomes clear. It simply, in his view, will not go there. So I have a picture of a kitten looking in the mirror and seeing a lion. I suspect that's kind of what Voegelin is thinking people are doing. Philosophers of this modern, whether it's Marxist or in some other ideology, or just the modern positivist point of view that says, this is enough, I am enough. And, you know, I mean, it kind of resonates with what we're told to do when we look into a mirror and give ourselves positive affirmations, right? We want to see the lion, but the lion ultimately, in Voegelin's view, is God, the source of eternal truth. So it's a classic juxtaposition in a way between Marxist atheism as he sees it. I don't think Marxism necessarily has to be atheistic. But, you know, but certainly Marx was an atheist. At any rate, Voegelin is opposing more or less the theism that is necessary if we start to think of ultimate origins in a human way, and atheism as it's exemplified by Marx. So then he goes into, he sort of systematizes or gives us a little bit of an image. He says there are three levels of deception. The first is simple error. The second level is when you persist in that error despite the awareness of your initial self-deception. And then the third level is what he calls, again, being rather strong language for a scholar, demonic mendacity, okay, which is continuing in full knowledge of your motive, which would be to close towards the transcendent, and to say to yourself that you or mankind is enough. So here, I think maybe what I should do is just read a bit from a couple of pages, because I think that he can do better than I can here. So he says, on the surface lies the deception itself. Oh, and this is from page 25. On the surface lies the deception itself. It could be self-deception, and very often it is, when the speculation of a creative thinker, has culturally degenerated and become the dogma of a mass movement. But when the phenomenon is apprehended at its point of origin, as in Marx or Nietzsche, deeper than the deception itself, will be found the awareness of it. The thinker does not lose control of himself. The libido dominandi turns on its own work and wishes to master the deception as well. I'll stop here and just for a second. I like the distinction he makes between the mass movement in which many people commit error and are guided by leaders who are also perhaps, you know, swept up in ideological enthusiasm and the desire for power. And he distinguishes between that and what happens with the original thinkers, Marx and Nietzsche in this case, who are committing the deeper deception because of their awareness of it, that they are the theoreticians and they understand what they're doing, in other words. And out of perhaps, at least in Nietzsche's case, a sense of despair, they make this move, which closes to questions, and they do so consciously. And then he says, this Gnostic turning back on itself corresponds spiritually, as we have said, to the philosophic conversion, the periagogue in the Platonic sense, that is the turning towards something else, the turning around. However, the Gnostic movement of the spirit does not lead to the erotic opening of the soul, but rather to the deepest reach of persistence in the deception, where revolt against God is revealed to be its motive and purpose. Okay, so that's from page 25. And then I'll just read a bit of section 3, where he then ties Nietzsche back into Marx. He says the first and second of the three stages can be seen in the texts we have quoted from Marx. How does Marx stand with respect to the third stage in this movement of the spirit, where rebellion against God is revealed to be the motive for the deception? This is exactly what is revealed in the context of the quoted passages. And then he quotes Marx, one of the early manuscripts. Marx says, a being regards itself as independent only when it stands on its own feet, and it stands on its feet only when it owes its existence to itself alone. A man who lives by the grace of another considers himself a dependent being, but I live by the grace of another completely if I owe him not only the maintenance of my life, but also its creation. If he is the source of my life, and my life necessarily has a cause outside itself, if it is not my own creation. I'll read that last sentence over again. And my life necessarily has such a cause outside itself, if it is not my own creation. Now, there's probably more than one way to read that quote by Marx. The other way to read it would be to see the source of creation in this case as the source of the reproduction of the human being, which would be the capitalist. In other words, I could read this and see in it an economic statement, and he's merely talking about economics and that we cannot reproduce ourselves under capitalism. We have to rely upon the capitalist and money in order to do that. And so there's this great dependency that's created in capitalism and a great deal of power over us. So having not read this particular manuscript, or at least not for a long time, I can't tell you for sure. But I don't know for sure if Marx is talking about what Voegelin thinks he's talking about. Because Voegelin clearly takes this as an early sort of rejection of God creator. Now, surely Marx did rather openly reject religion and God, so there's no argument there. But whether he did so here and whether this is evidence of Marx's full consciousness of what he's doing in the same way that Nietzsche was fully conscious of what he was doing, that's another matter. I do think Nietzsche was fully conscious of what he was doing, and that's why he was such a tormented person. I don't know if Marx would fall into that same category, but I'll read just a little bit more. He says, Voegelin says, Marx does not deny that tangible experience argues for the dependence of man, but reality must be destroyed. This is the great concern of Gnosis. In its place steps the Gnostic, who produces the independence of his existence by speculation. It would indeed be difficult to find another passage in Gnostic literature that so clearly exposes this speculation as an attempt to replace the reality of being with a, quote, second reality. A passage from Marx's doctoral dissertation of 1840 to 41 takes us still further into the problem of revolt. Quote from Marx, philosophy makes no secret of it. The confession of Prometheus, in a word, I hate all the gods, is its own confession, its own verdict against all gods, heavenly and earthly, who do not acknowledge human self-consciousness as the supreme deity. There shall be none beside it. In this confession, says Vogelin, in which the young Marx presents his own attitude under the symbol of Prometheus, the vast history of the revolt against God is illuminated as far back as the Hellenic creation of the symbol. Again, now this is a quote that clearly shows that Marx is rejecting the idea of God or the gods, but whether he does so with full conscious self-deception is still another matter. So I don't know like how much of Vogelin's argument hinges on full conscious self-deception, but it looks like quite a bit. So this is an outstanding question, right? And I should be able to get through the rest of this section next time. The book takes longer than you would think, because even though it's rather short, it's kind of dense. Now, the next, maybe I'll get into the next full chapter, because the next full chapter is entitled The Murder of God. So that would go along pretty well with how we've ended here. All right. So this is Vogelin's Science, Politics, and Gnosticism. Don't forget to sign up for the free Morin Academy newsletter. I'll put the link in the notes below. Political Philosophy is a Morin Academy podcast. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.